Welcome to Community in Unity, Pathways in and Out of Homelessness. It's part of Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series. I'm Ann Hellman. The conversation was recorded on April 25th, 2017, in the Stolt Building in downtown Anchorage, one of the city's emergency overflow shelters.
So I'd like to start the conversation by sort of just framing the issue in the context of Anchorage. And according to the 2016 point in time count, which attempts to count everyone who is in the state and is experiencing homelessness, it says about 2,000 people in Alaska are homeless. And I'm wondering how accurate that number is. And I'm seeing a definite shaking of the head.
Lisa from Beans Cafe. No, you know, the point in time count is a challenge always, and it's a national measure, and it's something that we need to do as a community. But I don't think we are always able to capture everyone. We just looked at our data from the emergency overflow shelter that we conducted this winter, and we had 667 unique individuals that stayed with us from January through the end of March. So I question those numbers a little bit. I think that it's hard to find people, whether they're camping, they're in a car, they're somewhere that's not easy to find many times. And, you know, I understand the intent of the point in time count, but I don't think we can take it literally as that is the total number of homeless people in our community.
Looking at kind of the overall picture of homelessness within Anchorage, within Alaska, I was wondering if any of you would be willing to share stories or experiences about how it is that you might have become homeless, or kind of assumptions that you feel like people make about individuals who are experiencing homelessness. Frances, would you be interested?
Okay, so my husband and I, we were married for 14 years, and then in 2007, he died of lung cancer. And so I was used to him paying the bills and taking care of me. And then when he left, so did the rent and the groceries. And so I'm learning in the process of learning how to get myself off of the streets with the help of the Downtown Soup Kitchen, learning about life skills, of going to church, and learning new skills and so that I can one day pay for my own apartment.
After your husband passed and you started living a bit on the streets, what was that transition like for you? Was it just from one day to the next a change?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I ran out of the rent money that my husband had left, and then I ended up at the Brother Francis shelter. It is a culture shock in a lot of senses. There is mental disabilities. There's also chronic alcohol abuse, and also drugs that people are addicted to.
Would you all agree that this is sort of things you've seen? I see you
definitely
nodding.
Definitely. There is a distinction, though, between shelter people and non-shelter people, whether you're in Anchorage or Fairbanks. Well, you have, as you stand, people with Brother Francis, and in Fairbanks we have our shelter down there on 23rd. And people who live there do tend to be into the drugs more. And then there's people like me who don't live at the shelters. And we, even more so than the shelters, have to band together as communities for safety. Otherwise, you're just pickings. But there is a definite distinction.
Where do you live if you're not living at the shelters?
Currently, I'm living in what's, I guess, a molehill. It's, you ever read The Shire, like Hobbit Town? Yeah, it's pretty much that. There's more of the building is inside the ground than outside the ground.
Why have you chosen that as your shelter instead of going to the emergency shelters?
Because it was more secure than my tent, and the man who'd built it offered to share his area with me.
Can we talk, you just mentioned that you had built this community. Can you tell me a little bit more about
the community's always existed. It's a matter of being accepted, which means holding yourself in a fashion and acceptable to their standards, whichever community it is.
Okay.
I mean, you have communities of drug users, you have communities of active go-getters who are trying to better themselves, you have communities of people who choose this lifestyle for their own reasons but don't wish to cause other harm or drain on the community. I'm one of those.
Can you tell me why you made that choice?
Because as she was saying, rent extremely high no matter where you go. If you can find a way to get an income without having to pay a rent, you are much better off.
And Sherry, I see you nodding to everything he said. Do you want to jump in here?
Well, he's right. There are different communities of homelessness. I'm Sherry Laurie from the Downtown Soup Kitchen Hope Center. And what we experience, we have a 50-bed women's shelter that is actually connected with Brother Francis, but we bring the women up to stay at the Downtown Soup Kitchen Hope Center. And the ones that come in there really are looking to not be around the alcohol and the drugs, but to just have a place of peace, a place where they don't have to be always on the defensive or protect themselves so much. There's much more space. And Frances, she stays up there with us, and so a lot of them get into the culinary programs, and they're trying to come out of their situation.
Is that what others of you who are working out in the field are seeing, that there's large groups of people who are trying different methods to get out of their situations?
To a point. It's, again, choices on the individual's part. You know, I know some who will never leave this lifestyle. I myself have a house on the bank of the Yukon River. I just don't wish to live there. There's 100 people that live in that town. That's where I grew up. But I've found no matter which town I'm in, the biggest need that people need is what I refer to as vocational rehab. So it's not rehab, but it's not you need to pay to go get a skill and a job. They need something that will do all of it.
Did you say vocational rehab or locational rehab?
Vocational. That's what I refer to it as. Vocational.
Okay.
As in, like, you come here, we clean you up, you put into the program, and when you do leave the program, not only are you off what you need to be off of, but you have a job and hopefully even placement. That's what's needed everywhere I've been.
Do programs like that exist here?
You know, that's something we've been doing more of. Again, this is Lisa from Beans Cafe. We've been doing more of that. We've really taken our, what for many years had been our volunteer programs. Every day we have over 120 jobs that our volunteers do. What we've turned them into is workforce development tracks. So we have three tracks that we can help people through, whether it's, you know, kitchen, prep and dishwashing. It could be the administrative side. Maybe they want to come into the client service offices, learn how to use a computer, learn how to file, learn how to do those types of functions. Or it could be general maintenance and janitorial. All great employment options for people. We work very closely with Sherry in the Downtown Soup Kitchen. We're trying to put together kind of a systems change approach for people who are currently experiencing homelessness so that we can kind of assess them, see what are the assets we have in our community, and how do we plug people into the right program. And so that's really kind of our effort that we're working on right now with the municipality and United Way.
So is that the solution? Is we just train people on how to do different jobs? Or is there more to it?
I mean, I guess I would just question, if I'm hearing this individual say that there's people that choose homelessness, then how do we understand the different, I mean, if someone was to choose homelessness, are these the same individuals that would want to go into this type of vocational programming? Or how do we, identify who wants to be part of maybe a program and working towards self-sustainability, or individuals that want to live that lifestyle? Because I have met individuals that want that and hands off, and I completely say okay. But I also want to know how to help the ones that do want the help. And I don't know how to tell the difference, and I don't know what to do about it.
Okay, so one, would other people support the idea that there are, in fact, individuals who choose to be homeless? Or yes?
I'm Nancy. I'm with the mayor's office and have worked for many years with homeless populations and with people particularly with mental health or substance use addictions. And if you engage someone, and I don't know you in particular, I'm interested to know you, but when I engage people and I ask, you know, do you want to do a program, or do you want to do this or that? The fact is that they've probably struggled with rent for a very long time. They've probably struggled with being on the edge and not quite having enough to keep it together. And that by the time they're on the street, they've lost hope. And I think that is what drives someone to wall off and say, no, I don't want to do that. But some of the people that I spoke with who went into our housing programs had tried treatment multiple times, and I don't say it, but they said they failed. And people begin to believe that they can't do it and that we don't have anything for them. And that's when I think you get that response. And it can come with a lot of anger, or it can come with a lot of surety that I don't really believe exists. And so the way that we're approaching this work from the mayor's office is that everyone has something they should do or can do, and we want to help connect them to it. And it's not for us to say it should be this vocational thing or that thing. Maybe it's reuniting with family. Maybe it's finding that next person who's the love of your life. Who knows what it is? We want you to find that, and we want to give you a safe space to do it in.
I work as a funder, and so we go around and try and educate ourselves. And the one thing we hear from the different program providers is first you need hope, and then you need dignity to be able to move out of these lower levels. And that's what's really needed, and it comes from lots of different areas, whether it's addiction assistance, vocational assistance, rent assistance, and so there's lots of different things that have to be approached simultaneously.
Would others of you agree that it's just that people lack hope, or what do you think?
That's the biggest reason, yes, is hope. Lacking hope. Because it's not that they can't succeed or don't succeed, it's that they failed. They fear they can't succeed, so therefore they won't try anymore. My current wife is a prime example. She lacks hope because she doesn't think that she can do good or be good enough for anyone or anything, and therefore is consistently and constantly making her life harder.
You say that applies to your current wife, but does that mean that you do have hope? And if so, tell us why or how.
Because I have faith. I have faith. You know, I know that God provides no matter what, even if it's small and slim and hard to find. You know, I don't question it. I don't look for it. It's there. Therefore, no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay.
I would be in complete agreement with the hope thing. Last Friday and Saturday, we held a seminar at the Downtown Soup Kitchen Hope Center, and it was called Keys to Transforming Your Heart. And the subjects were how we see God, forgiveness, childhood trauma, and sexual abuse. And by the end of the day, we had 20 of the women from the shelter in that, and every one of them came out saying, I feel like I have hope again. I feel like I'm okay. And it was really about their value and their dignity, and that life goes on. Their life didn't end where the trauma happened. And so it was amazing to see these guys come out and say, this is going to change us. We're going to be different. And there has been a difference in the shelter since having that hope put into them.
Would you say the shelter gives you, like, you've gone from not having much after your husband passed to now being on your way to a career in the culinary arts. Like, how did you transform yourself in that way?
Well, the best way of transforming is going to the classes like life skills. We're taught that, you know, everybody makes mistakes, and that when we make a mistake, it's okay. As long as we learn from the mistake, then it's a good mistake. And so the staff there, they're very kind and respectful and very helpful. I was very frightened when I got there, but they treated me with respect and kindness, and they gave me hope.
Why were you frightened when you got there?
Oh, well, you know, the there's a lot of the homeless people who are not nice. Yeah, they're very rough.
You're listening to Community in Unity, a conversation about pathways in and out of homelessness. It was recorded in Anchorage in April 2017. You just heard from Francis, a participant in the Culinary Arts School at the Downtown Soup Kitchen Hope Center. I visited the Feed Me Hope program over the winter. Julia Moore walks through the kitchen at the Hope Center Downtown Soup Kitchen in Anchorage, pointing at the vegetable prep area and giant freezers. Then she remembers something way more important.
Oh, let's go check my dessert. Oh, I forgot my dessert in the oven.
She rushes across the crowded room and pulls a large metal tray of apple crumble out of the oven.
Smell that.
She says she loves baking desserts because, unlike vegetables, they make people the happiest.
I can't get excited about chopping up yams, you know?
Moore is midway through the 12-week-long culinary program at the soup kitchen. She joined the school because the conditions of her release from prison into a halfway house required that she get a job, and she wasn't having any luck.
And I mean, I was applying at Wendy, I was applying everywhere, and nobody was interested. You know, I have a lot of tattoos, I'm older, I hadn't been employed in over 10 years.
Now, every morning she joins 10 other students for training that applies to all jobs, not just kitchen etiquette. For the first half of the day, they take life skills classes. Then, in the afternoon, they learn to cook. Everything the students prepare is served for dinner to the 50 women who sleep at the Hope Center, which is a soup kitchen by day and an emergency shelter by night. The program is privately funded through donations and catering sales. Chef David Sorensen teaches the cooking classes. He says the skills he imparts, how to hold a knife, how to make vinaigrette, are important, but won't necessarily help his students keep a job. First, they need to learn to deal with their inner gremlins.
With those voices, i.e. gremlins in your head, they're telling you you're not good enough, you're a failure, you can't do this. If we can't get them to a point where they can overcome those voices, there won't be gainfully employed, and that's the reason why they're here.
So while he teaches them to dice peppers, he also talks about his life and checks in on how the students are doing outside of class. Sorensen says he's been where many of his students have. He's in recovery from alcohol addiction and was homeless when he was young.
In the past, if somebody had said, hey, I've got a culinary job for you as a teacher, I would have not lasted 2 months. I would have just said, would have chucked it all in and said, nah, I can't do this, you know, because I would have still been not sober.
Sobriety is one of the program requirements. Students undergo random drug tests and are asked to use a breathalyzer if program staff suspect they're drinking. Sorensen says people who are caught using will get another shot at staying in the program, but they have to agree to stop using substances. Feed Me Hope is modeled after Fair Start in Seattle, which has run a culinary and life skills program for 30 years. 90% of their adult graduates get jobs within 3 months of finishing the program. So far, 3 people have graduated from Feed Me Hope in Anchorage. 11 more are on track to finish in late spring, and Moore is one of them. She says she doesn't plan on getting a culinary job when she finishes, but she's definitely learned some things that will help her in life.
I don't work well with others. I do better by myself. That's why I'm an artist. But I'm getting used to working with people, and which is a good thing. People are okay, I guess.
Moore pulls her dessert out of the oven, the edges brown and bubbly, then heads into the walk-in refrigerator to make the final preparations for the night's meal. And now back to the conversation.
So from this corner, I'm hearing a big vote for give people hope, and then we can kick this thing in the butt. Is that all there is to it? What else?
I think we're talking now about probably a smaller segment of the homeless population that everybody has focus on right now.
What do you mean a smaller segment that everyone has focus on?
Well, these guys are trying. They're doing something. They're getting an education. They're getting some skills. They're trying to go back to work. I've worked with this population for probably 20 some odd years. We started the Carlick Manor program, which was the first Housing First program up here, and it was we filled that in 2 months. You know, we had 46 beds and we had 75 people ready to come in, and we filled the whole thing in 2 months. And a lot of those folks are still there, but there, people have lived there for 5 years and they still consider themselves homeless. So they haven't really gotten out of that mindset. It takes a long time for them to get out of the mindset that they really have a place. They some of these guys still don't consider that home, even though they've lived there for 5 years.
Have you asked them why?
Well, sure, and they've been kicked out. They've been moved on so many times that they never really feel that that is home. And we find that there'll be some people they'll get a job, they'll feel good about themselves, they'll stop drinking for a period of time, and I think that all the good things that happen to them, they feel that they don't deserve it. And then they self-sabotage and they go back to drinking again. But we give them, I think we're one of the most tolerant landlords in Alaska because we give them chance after chance after chance. And some of the people have been through our programs 8 different times, you know, and some of them then will succeed. And there's some of them that will, I think this is the best that's ever going to happen to some of them. You know, they've been in on the streets for so long that, there's a lot of things going on. There's some dementia going on. There's disease going on. There's health issues, and a big portion of the population, I don't think will ever work. And having stable housing and maybe an income through Medicaid and getting Medicaid and maybe Social Security is going to be the best that's going to happen.
And that's when they start to lose hope, because then that's a outward showing of the inward feeling of not being good enough. I have to ask the government for paying me every month because I can't do it myself. And that's where it begins.
It's something that they deserve. I mean, the people, everybody deserves a chance, and everybody, and if that's where they can get it, I mean, everybody deserves, everybody pays into Social Security. So it's a benefit that people should have, you know. Yeah.
But I feel like the argument you're making is that, okay, so they're living off of subsidies, but that's not enough to give a feeling of self-worth, and thus it leads to sabotage.
Because it's not what they're doing themselves. It's something else that someone else provided. In the end, that's what gives people self-value, mm-hmm. which is the next thing behind hope that's needed.
So this is Callie, Beans Cafe Program Manager. One of the things that's going through my mind when we're talking about all of this is, for those of us who are working in the field, you know, connection to our people is what is crucial to me. We make a connection. That means showing up when we say we're going to show up. I've done outreach, been a probation officer, I worked at Beans. So it's all about, a lot of the people that we work with are used to people coming in their lives and leaving, whether it's from childhood or adulthood or in many different ways, people leave. And so I think one of the things that is so important for us is to connect with the people that we serve and show up at the times, you know, after 5 o'clock and, you know, sometimes at 10 o'clock and build up that trust, which will assist them with the self-respect, the dignity, and to help people want to get where they want to get by choice. You know, whether, like Nancy said, a loved one or whatever motivates them. So, you know, it's just, this is such a, just a very interesting topic. There's just really no one solution. It takes all of us committed to help people help figure out what it is they would like and help them achieve that. Whether we house people 5 times, because that has happened, you know, we don't ever give up, you know, and it's just, I really think we're doing a good job. I just want to say that also, you know, I'm always open to new ideas and everything, of course, but I think building connections with the people that we serve is like the most important thing to, I know for me as a program manager, as well as our client services.
And I feel like remembering that those connections don't stop when a person gets housed, that those connections go long beyond that. I'm sorry, my name is Melissa at Beans Cafe. But one of the biggest things that we see at Beans Cafe is the community and the sense of community that our clients build amongst each other. That's their family. Those are their people. And so if somebody gets housed, I mean, we have somebody who's housed and comes back almost every day and still volunteers there because she likes being around people, and being in your apartment by yourself isn't the same thing. And so those connections are still incredibly important even once a person is, you know, in their next step.
This is Lisa again from Beans. I really think that, you know, there's several issues that you have to deal with. Housing, you know, and I'm a big fan of Housing First. I think that's, you know, a great model. Sure, just that instead of the model that had been traditionally used for years, which was, you know, get sober, get a job, get some income, and then you can earn housing, it's kind of putting it on its head and saying, okay, first we're going to provide you housing, and then we're going to work on all of your other issues. Because frankly, if you aren't safe at night or have a place to lay your head, how can you focus on anything else? You're just in survival mode. I give so much credit to our clients that every day are sleeping at the shelter and trying to go to work and trying to scrounge up a bus pass to get there or walk walking miles to get there. You know, if you can take one thing off of them and give them that base of stable housing, that's huge. That's huge. And then you have to wrap the support services around them. You really need to provide them with the mental health counseling, with the addiction support that they may need. But I think the one thing that I love that we're talking about a lot tonight is instilling that sense of purpose. And to me, you know, you can have all these things. People can be housed. They can have their addiction treatment. They can have mental health counseling. But if they don't have a sense of purpose, there's no reason to get out of bed in the morning. There's no reason to go to that next meeting. There's no reason to stay sober. And I think that that's really important to remember. And whether your sense of purpose is coming in volunteering or, like Nancy said, reconnecting with your family, maybe watching your grandson one afternoon a week, whatever it may be, but we have to help people find that.
What are some ideas that people have for how the wider community can help do that?
My name is Chris. I'm from the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I wanted to share an initiative that we got started 2 years ago with the Anchorage Gospel Rescue Mission Recovery Program and Habitat for Humanity, where we had men that were in the recovery program who elected to volunteer for Habitat for Humanity on Saturdays. Although these gentlemen weren't getting paid for their work, they were able to engage with the community. They didn't have the stigma of being in a recovery program or living in a shelter because they weren't at a shelter. They were outside off the campus, and they were interacting with a lot of different levels of our community. There were, you know, executives from BP and other carpenters there, and it really had a pretty profound impact on the guys that were able to establish bonds and relationships with these people outside of their circle. And I think that promoting initiatives like that, that engage different organizations, and rather than starting a new organization or things like that, where you take established community organizations and pull them together for a mutually beneficial outcome, can be really impactful. You know, having this work crew from the rescue mission go to Habitat every Saturday really helped Habitat out a lot, because they could count on these five guys or four guys or whatever that were showing up every Saturday and really providing a really consistent and quality service there. So they knew that they had this like mini crew, and so it really helped Habitat. It also helped the workers there from the Habitat to strip down some of the stigma that they had of the homeless people in Anchorage, because they see these guys not as you know, panhandlers on the corners, but as really skilled laborers and craftsmen that could do really good work and that were inspired and motivated for change. And so I think those types of initiatives can be extraordinarily dynamic. And I think there are these cool little projects that are going that are kind of similar. To me, those are the things and those are the initiatives that are really going to help give people the self-efficacy and value, and then the motivation to continue and, you know, the jumpstart. So,
are there other programs like that that are going on?
Bagels Ministry. He started this program just a year ago based off of his experience in the camps up there. And he came to me because last winter I pushed a shovel for 2 months without ever getting a dime, just to show people that we're willing to do something. And he employs people up there in Fairbanks from the camps that don't go to the missions, whether they wish to clean themselves up or not, to help better the community. So there are programs beginning. It's just they need more.
Was that kind of the idea behind the work van, Nancy, to sort of consistently show up for people?
Yeah, we had a little extra money from the assembly last year and wanted to try an idea that would do two things. One, that would help the community view the homeless population in a different way as people who were contributing and a really valued part of our community, to sort of reunite them with community, and second, to do some really practical cleanup around the community that needed to get done at bus stops and other locations. But I think the thing, your question about what can the community do to help this, is that we need to tap into the creativity of the community, because there's probably 1,000 ideas like this out there. I'm thrilled to hear the Habitat idea. I'd never thought of that. And there are so many people who could just do something for one or two folks. I do know that people sometimes have, after we did the work van program, we did realize that people sometimes need a couple of different tries. They might make it to work a few days and then not make it. So inconsistency can be a problem. If you need a regular crew, you have to figure out where to select your participants. But there's creativity in this community that could wrap around all of the services we do. And we've talked about trying to engage those communities to see what's happening at Beans, and is there a piece that's happening at Beans that might be going out into the community? Or after someone moves into their apartment, can they be visited by community members? Can they be invited to join a running club or a knitting group? You know, is there ways that we can help make those connections? Because that's what it is, it's connections.
Something that you touched on, and a couple of you have touched on, is this idea that we need to start dispelling the stigma and dispelling the myth surrounding homelessness. And I guess I'd like to talk a little bit, it's kind of a two-parter. What do you think some of the misconceptions about homelessness are, and how do we get rid of those?
I think what happens around this group and everybody, we actually get to know their story. So other people don't see them as homeless. They see them as a problem. They see them as you're loitering, or there's you can't use my bathroom or anything like that. And we actually get to know them. We know who this guy used to own a house, or this guy was married, had three kids, and this guy speaks three languages. This guy used to be a pilot. And there's very, very interesting stories around this population, but you have to get to know them. And people don't take the time. And I think we take the time, we get to know them on that level, and then it's easier to plug them in. You know that somebody had experience many years ago in a hospital, so maybe they could be a PCA now. Or somebody used to work construction, so they have some of that knowledge. Or they used to be a chef, or they had that type of experience. We used to get people work, and we'd ask them questions. Says, no, I don't have any supervisor experience. Well, tell me what you used to do. I used to be a fishing captain. My goodness, you know, if you ran a boat, if you were a captain on a fishing boat, you have some experience with that. So I think it's getting to know them and who they are, and keeping that connection. One of the hardest things we find is that they live in these community settings like Carluck Manor and Safe Harbor and things like that. And even at the shelter, there's a community. They have people to talk to. They have people to bounce things off of. There's always somebody there for them. And then they feel like, okay, I'm getting ready. I'm moving out. I'm going to be on my own. And they move into housing, and they have four walls and maybe a TV. And it's tough to deal with. And that's where they need the extra support. Once somebody moves on and they feel like, oh, my goodness, I'm making this great step. I have my own place. Now they have the problem start all over again, you know, and that's when they need a lot of support.
Are there ways, I mean, other than like news media or conversations like this, are there ways to get those personal stories out to the general population, or ways for people who aren't working in agencies that are involved in issues of homelessness and who maybe don't think they have time to volunteer, to connect with individuals who are experiencing homelessness so we can reduce the stigma for the population as a whole?
Hi, it's Lisa Caldera. I'm the program director of Brother Francis Shelter. And I would say that pretty much every day I see those connections being made. And it comes from every single walk of life here in Anchorage. First of all, I think that there is great sympathy and empathy coming from fellow community members in Anchorage. If you think of how many people go to Brother Francis Shelter, it's almost 1% of Anchorage's population. That's how many people come through our doors. So you think if each person who comes through our doors, they have a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, they have family, and then that's that intimate circle, people who know their stories, probably tried a million times with them before they ended up at our doors. But there's that group there that know people who are experiencing homelessness. But on top of that, you have community members who just care. They care because they don't know anyone, and they're just looking for purpose or a way to connect. I mean, we've got second graders who make us little mittens and scarves and hats, you know, so they're even starting when they're young to make those connections. But we've seen it when folks are dropping by and they're giving us donations, they're coming in, they're volunteering. I'm sure a lot of agencies in here, sitting in this room, can't operate without volunteers. you know, and I mean, you're thinking of your retired teachers, your students, professionals who are coming in on service days. Each one of those people therefore have an experience, if it's with the agency or somebody who's experiencing homelessness, to then take with them, right? So for me, to answer your question, I think three questions ago, the idea of stereotypes, I mean, it could almost be applied to anything, right? If there's a stereotype, it's usually because there's a preconceived notion that then gets reinforced because of a story that I heard or a guy that I saw, somebody I once knew. So it's all about getting beyond the unknown. Sometimes I hear that people don't even want to come down to the Brother Francis Shelter and Beans Cafe campus. It breaks my heart. I'm like, I'm there every single day. But there's like a moat to cross, and it's not even a physical one, it's a mental one. You know, and I think once we can get people past that, you're going to be able to make those better connections. But for us, it's we can get them in. We can even take our message to you if you want. We've got, what do you call those? The different civic groups in town as well. You know, I mean, visiting these groups and sharing knowledge to then inspire them to give of their time or resources or something like that is always a great way to connect on many levels.
I agree with everything Lisa just said. She's amazing. I'm Elizabeth, a community member. I'm on the board of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, and I'm a part of a church that does the emergency cold weather shelter for homeless families. So two questions ago, you asked what are our maybe misconceptions of homelessness? And I think a lot of people have in their mind that a homeless person in Anchorage is maybe an adult male that frequents the Brother Francis Shelter. And they do not picture the growing number of families and young children working hard. So a misconception, too, would be somebody that's homeless is lazy. I've never met somebody lazy. In our connections in our church with the most hardworking families who've had a crisis or a situation that has brought them into homelessness. And that's a side of homelessness. These families, young children in the school district, working very hard with the children in transition program to stay in the same school district, even if they are moving night to night to night throughout the community of Anchorage to different incredible faith communities, housing them. They're still getting their homework done. They're still doing all their work. They're incredibly hardworking people that need community support. So I know we've got another community member here who's very instrumental in the emergency cold weather shelter that could speak to that as a connection. I think that is a way for community members to be invited in maybe a less scary way. And Lisa, I don't know if you would say some of that moat is, I think, fear. People are afraid. And sometimes in churches, it's maybe a safer place to say, why don't you give one night and work in this shelter program and meet a few of the families? And once people do that and they give a little bit of time and they meet some of those families, that fear starts to dissipate because they can see a little bit of part of their story in the person's story that's in front of them. So that's been reiterated many times. Connections, relationships, hearing people's story. I don't think there's any substitute for the depth of that.
I think one of the things that, sorry, I don't know what your name is.
Chris
as well. So, I think guys like yourself and the women like yourself that choose to live a life of homelessness, and because that's the lifestyle that you want, and that works for you. I think in our culture that values self-efficacy and like personal choice and personal and autonomy so much in our American culture, when we hear these narratives from folks that are like, yeah, I choose, that's the lifestyle I want, I think we latch on to that narrative as a society and then just decide that's what every person who experiences homelessness wants, that's their choice, that's what their choice is. I think it's one of those myths similar to like addiction, where like a person's addicted to heroin and they're like, well, they must be choosing to do that because if they didn't want to be addicted to heroin, they just stop, right? And not really understanding like the dopaminergic pathways and things like that. And so I think helping our community understand that although there are people that are happy to live this lifestyle and want that lifestyle, there's a huge population where if they had the option, they would be working, and if they had the option, they would be in a warm home with their family and with their loved ones. And I think helping our community understand that there is a huge population of people who experience homelessness and addiction, that's what their end goal is, not necessarily the narrative of I want to live this way. So, and that doesn't take anything away at all from the people who do choose to live that way, but I think that's a narrative that our culture likes to grab onto because of the fear of crossing the moat and seeing what's on the other side. because I believe that that's what it is, then I don't have to go over there. So
just, I want to address a piece of that around the choice of being homeless. And after working the years that I've worked in homelessness services, I think I've really met one person who said that they choose that lifestyle and really was, but that person also had a very intense fear of a phobia of being closed in. And so it was challenging for them to be inside. But I do hear, I think we need to also speak to the social justice component of this, that in a community where a single family home price is over $300,000, and the option for someone someone who's coming out of homelessness is almost guaranteed to spend their entire life in a rental market. And in Anchorage, our rental market was established in the 70s and 80s. It's not a very good rental market. There's high density. And a one-bedroom unit costs you, now it's more than $1,020 a month. So you're going to then work your full job to basically pay your rent. Or if you do get Social Security, your Social Security allowance is about $1,000. So you're going to pay 100% of your income just to remain housed. And that's not a way that we can continue as a community. There's no option for someone to really gain stability, which is ownership. I think everyone has the dream as a kid, I'm going to grow up, I'm going to own a house, I'm going to have a dog and some other people around me or whatever. That's not even an option for a growing segment of our population. And in communities where you can track the single family home price, homelessness tracks with it. As it goes up, you have more homeless people. And so, you know, they're just really, to me, there is no person who's choosing homeless to be homeless. There are people who are choosing that they, or some people who are not able to tolerate a tight, dense, crappy rental market, or the idea that they will never have true stability because their landlord could change tomorrow and they're out. So I just really think that economic piece needs to be added into the conversation.
You're pointing out the rental markets. You know, 2 years ago, my wife had an apartment over here, and it did. It took every dime of her Social Security to keep us in there. And I spent every day of, you know, going around gathering food and the things of every day. And when they upped their price for the summer's month is when we lost it. And she hasn't gained another one since. She's currently living, you know, at her sister's house. But by choosing to be homeless is that I'm not going to go into the renting market. And I know I'm not going to unless somebody gives me a good paying job, which nobody wants to give you the chance to give a job because, you know, you're either a thief or a junkie or lazy. And that's just the way it is.
You're listening to Community and Unity, a conversation about homelessness. Many of the participants at the April event spoke about the assumptions people make about those who are experiencing homelessness. An Alaska playwright recently tried to counter those stereotypes with her play Home, But Not Less. Rumpled tarps hang against the walls of an old church, serving as backdrops for the eight actors that circle the audience's seating area.
So many of us live on the edge.
One medical incident.
One paycheck.
The lines are just snippets from over 100 interviews with people who have experienced homelessness and those who offer them services. Playwright Mary Ellefson began researching the play after meeting a young man who was living on the street and grieving the loss of his grandfather. She was hoping to understand not just what it was like to be without a home, but also what are the causes of homelessness in Alaska. She says everyone's story starts in a different place.
If I'm sitting underneath a bridge and talking to someone who his parents were encouraging him to drink at age 2 and laughing, his life trajectory is going to be a lot different than mine for a lot of different reasons.
Through her conversations, Ellefson says she identified what her interviewees see as some of the major causes of homelessness.
Mental illness, housing, 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 poverty, 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 how they're related, how they're not related. Racism and discrimination plays a huge part of this. Education, sexual abuse, domestic violence.
Many community leaders say racist policies, such as forcing Alaska Natives to attend boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their languages, caused many people to lose their identities. It led to intergenerational trauma, which some people Ellefson spoke with link to causes of homelessness. Actor Austin Tagaban learned about some of these causes by participating in the production. He says he's never worried about being homeless.
If I didn't have somewhere to sleep that night, I could call someone and be like, hey, man, or hey, mom, let me sleep on your couch. And she'd be like, no, have this room, Austin.
He says he thought the answers to homelessness were simple. Why couldn't someone just get a job? But now he understands how complicated people's lives are and how much we can learn from them.
It's important to hear these stories because they're people who we usually ignore.
One of those stories is from Michael Patterson, who first became homeless in Juneau when he was 9 years old. It's told by actor George Holly.
In the mornings, when the stores opened, I would steal fruits off the displays. I lived like a rat, in a sense. So you know my self-worth was, it was destroyed.
For Holly, participating in the play is personal. He says learning about the support networks available to people helped him alleviate some of his own fears. Director Shona Osterhout says that's one of the main ideas of the production, to develop empathy and solutions.
This isn't about being sad about our neighbor's situation. This is actually about how do I learn about our neighbor's situation? What can I do to help? And how do I just be a better human on the planet?
And now for more Community and Unity.
Question a little while ago, how do you get the story out? How do people get their stories out? Years ago, we had a program at Homeward Bound, and we called it the Speakers Bureau. And what we did is we had a group of probably about six individuals who were homeless, and I'll tell you, they like to tell their story, especially if there's some success in there. They really like to tell their story. And we used to go to the police department, the judges' chambers, the Rotary clubs, schools, see young children and things like that. And we did a little survey before, is we'd ask them what they know about homelessness. And then afterwards, we'd ask them what did they learn about homelessness, you know. And I think it was pretty powerful for people to go out and tell their own story. And it was the first time in a long time, and the population I deal with mostly is a chronic homeless alcoholic. So for those folks to be able to interact with the police and the judges when they're sober, and for the judges and the police and other people to see them when they're sober, it was very eye-opening for both sides. And the program stopped because of funding and somebody who takes ownership of it. We had a fellow up here that used to run that all the time, but he left the state, and the program kind of crumbled around him. But I mean, I think that was something that maybe should be resurrected, to get a group of people, a group of homeless people, with one person to set up a schedule for them, and they go meet people and talk about it. And I think it's an education on both sides. It's very humbling sometimes for both parties, because you go to you know, we went once to grammar schools, and kids are very outspoken. They'll tell you exactly how they feel, you know, and they would say things that they're poor, they're crazy, they smell, they wear army clothes. I mean, that's the types of things that they would say. But after after they had it, they felt that, wow, these are real people, you know, and I think that's important to get that story out.
Beyond building empathy and understanding that homelessness impacts everybody. I mean, you often hear people are just one paycheck away. Are there other collaborations that need to happen between different community organizations?
I was actually just going to comment that I think one thing that we're missing here is that coordination of care, which you just brought up. I mean, because I've heard it, I think Lisa was saying, you know, we without a safe place to stay, how are individuals going to get employment? Or this individual was just talking about the substance abuse issues, and so it's all interrelated, and all intertwined. So addressing one, but then you have to address the other, and how do we all work together to make that system work?
Hi, I'm Dave. I work for the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness and United Way. Are there collaborations that need to go on? Yeah, there are more. Our community has to be in unity to figure this out, because other communities have actually statistically beaten homelessness. They've actually solved homelessness. And what I mean by that is that they have been able to reduce the amount of time that somebody is homelessness down to a number of discernible days, and that we don't have people that are saying that they're calling the shelter their home, and people that are staying in the shelter for 5 years. Our community, under the leadership of Mayor Berkowitz and the Governor Walker, is working on homelessness issues, is working with a broad group of folks, the Anchorage Coalition and Homelessness United Way, and all the service providers that are here tonight are part of this larger plan to end homelessness. But they're working together at the moment under this relatively new plan to end homelessness. And what we've got to and they're starting to work together in more and more ways and more interesting ways and collaborate in ways that maybe they haven't in the past, because just like any other organization, they're learning more things. And as they begin to trust more and as more positive relationships build among those people, they're better able to serve homeless clients, and they're able to see a broader array of people themselves. And that's those collaborations that are taking place right now are assisting us in assisting the people who are homeless.
So with these collaborations, I mean, you would expect that Beans and Brother Francis and Soup Kitchen and United, like, you would expect all of these organizations to be working together. Are you pulling in collaborators that aren't normally part of this conversation?
We are, you know, the so it's a new community, you know, Anchorage is a relatively new community, and we're pulling in now the government. We're pulling in a way in which really hadn't taken place before. We're pulling in funders in a way which really hadn't taken place before. We're pulling in our own university in a ways which didn't take place before. And the community is standing up. It's taken a lot of independent organizations that stood up really out of necessity, like Beans Cafe, Brother Francis, and they're pulling themselves not only up in the way in which to expand their service model, but they're creating different collaborations, necessary collaborations, to really achieve their mission, which is to actually end homelessness.
And you mentioned a couple times that there's a plan.
There is a plan.
What's the plan?
The plan that we have right now is a plan that it is a series of initiatives recognizing that people are on different spectrum of this hope continuum, and they're on different spectrum of this ready to assist on the provider side. But the plan really pulls this one thread all together, which is that all the people here who can help are going to help collectively. To describe the plan would be to describe this multi-layered thing. But what I could say, the most important thing that it does is it says we're all going to work together to get this done. And that's really, in my mind, it's the most significant element of the entire plan. And that's the same main element that every other community that's actually beat homelessness, they've done it. And when they haven't done it because they weren't able to really pull it together.
Hi, I'm Rochelle, and I'm just a volunteer who cares about our community. And I'm listening to all of these great ideas and initiatives and things. And one thing that I think helps a lot is that it's good to have initiatives. It's great to have groups and things like that. But if we don't get our next door neighbor aware of what's going on, if we can't help them see past the stigma and the stereotypes that so many people find easy to apply when they see someone on the street or at Brother Francis or at the Soup Kitchen, then we aren't going to be able to make the true difference, which is all of us coming together, seeing past a person and seeing the story or seeing the heart behind it. And today we are such a social media driven nation and world, honestly. There's pages like the Forget Me Not page, the Pay It Forward pages, like on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. These type of things are really a medium that is super important to talking to our Little League coaches and our teachers and our PTA board members who we see as we're waiting for our kids when we're out doing work. Getting those stories, absolutely. The stories are so important. I have found that the way you get those is you are consistent. You show up. No one's going to hope. No one's going to believe that there is something more for them than where they are right now if they don't trust you, if they don't know that you're really there, not to get a stroke, not to say that, oh, I'm part of this or I do this, but if they know you're there simply for them and you're consistent, whether that's once a week or once every other week or a couple times a day or once a month, that speaks volumes, so much more so than anything else. And being a volunteer who does that with no other purpose at heart except for that other person's well-being, people pick up on that. I, at one time, was a homeless teenager, and I didn't become homeless because I had addictions or anything like that. Those did come, but then I came out of that. So I had a different perspective, but I was shocked myself in realizing that I also sometimes had a stigma when I would see someone on a corner, just as I had pulled myself up and began to do things in my life as an adult. And I really, for me, it was faith-based. And I really had to come back to that center and remember that everyone has an intrinsic value. And it's not something we earn. It's something that is because we exist. And when I started to realize that, then I started to seek ways within the community that I could volunteer, that I could set an example for my children, for the girls that I coach softball for, the kids that I tutored, things like that. And when they see that it's a passion in your life, it becomes contagious. But I also use social media a lot because that gets those stories out there, because people are so busy, they don't always have the motivation to take the time to go and volunteer, you know, and check things out because of those stigmas. But social media will help you a lot in that. It's an impersonal, personal touch, for lack of a better way to say it. And it helps a lot. One other thing that I found lacking in Anchorage was there was not one source where I could find online that I could figure out, okay, these are the faith-based communities, and this is what they provide, these different churches. These are the city municipality offered sources and resources, government, all those type things. I couldn't find one thing, and I thought, my gosh, that has got to be so frustrating to someone who maybe does want a little bit of help or know what's available to them, but can't sit on a computer for an hour searching. And so I began to generate... We all know Google Drive, right? So I began to generate a sheet that separated these things, and I share those with my friends because, for me, I didn't even know all the things that my own church touched in the community. And I was really shocked by that, but I realized I could do something, and we can all do that. If we can share the knowledge, do it through social media. If you want to be involved, you know, want people to get involved, start sharing your own personal stories of your involvement, what you see. Let them see the passion. Let them see the hope in yourself. And it is so contagious. People can't help but want to begin to work upon that own little spark in them.
I was just going to go to what you're talking about, sharing. And I think everyone in the community, people who volunteer, the organizations, people who are working directly with the homeless, want to be impactful. And I think that if organizations could really share not just that they're doing good works, but they're being impactful, that could rally more people to be involved, because you want to feel good. I mean, really, there's a selfish motivation for volunteering. You want to feel good about what you're doing. And if you're putting money towards an organization, you want to make sure that it's going as far as it possibly can. So if organizations can share that we're not just doing good works, we're actually making a difference, I think that could go a long way into bringing the community to do more.
Well, I'd like to thank you all very much for coming here tonight and being part of this conversation and sharing your personal experiences. This has been Community and Unity, talking about pathways in and out of homelessness.
That was Community and Unity, part of Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series. The event was recorded in April 2017 at one of Anchorage's emergency overflow shelters. You can listen to other episodes at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for joining us.